Like a chorus of boos each time Michael Bradley touches the ball. It's That's So MLS with myself, Andrew Bates, and Nick Thornton.
Nice, yes. Hello.
How are you, Nick? It's been a lengthy international break, but soccer came back to North America.
Soccer did come back to North America. Yeah, I'm good. You know, nothing like watching playoff games on a Tuesday evening to get you in the mood for things to come. And yeah, I don't know. Ultimately, not too surprising and a little surprising at the same time, which we're kind of used to in this podcast.
I feel like the biggest effect of the lengthy break was to heighten anticipation, but also like remove any idea of who was and wasn't a underdog, because it's like, if you have 2 weeks to think about it, it's like, we have no idea what it's going to be like until the series starts. Whereas if you have like 2 days, it's going to be like, well, we just saw so-and-so pay so-and-so.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I guess in a weird sort of way, it does set it up to be a little, like builds up a little bit more anticipation, you know, and with the bit of drama and the international break, to sort of get people's minds off of it. I also feel like there's no better way to clear the decks of people who might have otherwise cared, but if you give them a couple of weeks, will no longer care. I'd love to see what it did to the ratings of the conference finals.
Yeah, it's hard to know just because, like, what the impact of momentum is. Because the only teams, I guess Houston still, like, Toronto is definitely going to have its eyes on it. And although the Grey Cup is coming this weekend, so it's a bad media week to start. But it was a bad media game for Toronto anyways, as Toronto FC visited MAPFRE Stadium and drew 0-0 against the Crew in a game I kind of felt, I don't know, I felt that even without Sebastian Giovinco missing on a second yellow and Jose Altidore, who was not able to appeal his red card, I feel like they could have got more.
Yeah, I think both sides will probably feel the same. I don't know. It's interesting that it seems to matter who the teams are, because, you know, when we're talking about Vancouver, we see a 0-0 draw at home as a positive,
right?
Even if it's a little boring. And when we talk about Columbus at home, Columbus fans will be disappointed they didn't get something out of it, and I think many will rightly say that was their chance. However, it does open up the interesting conversation, and I kind of wanted to get your thoughts on this. Is it simultaneously does two completely opposing things. One is that everybody's now saying it is Toronto's to win. There's no way Columbus goes to Toronto with a full squad of Toronto players and wins, right? Like there's no way Columbus can win this. However, of course, because it's in Toronto, away goals are a thing. And because they held Toronto to a clean sheet in Columbus, it's 0-0. So yeah, this really is the final. What are your thoughts?
I think that you get the counterpoint in terms of for the disappointment that Toronto might feel is that Columbus, in our early predictions for the Columbus New York City series, we were saying they might get one goal, they might get two goals, and they won 4-1. So by that standard, it was a success. And the difference between both that game and the Vancouver Seattle game, in which Seattle is missing Clint Dempsey, if I recall, is that Dempsey is not as key to the overall gameplay of the Sounders as I think both Altidore and Giovinco are when you when you put them together. I mean, you could swap one in, one out, but it, as much as I think that they did have a certain amount of, they still could have had a little bit more bite to them. It's a clear weakening of the side to be missing those two players.
Yeah, and it was really interesting in the pre-game and in the post-game commentary that everyone's like, oh, you know, this game is like, it's going to be a lot more attacking and Toronto's going to take the game to them. And while there were elements of that, I really did feel like Toronto parked the bus. And even in the lineup, I mean, they, for all intents and purposes, had five at the back and really did maybe not park the bus in a formation sense, but in a tactical sense, Columbus had very few opportunities going forward. And Toronto just clearly tried to clog up the midfield and definitely had some chances that they weren't able to take. But really, it felt like Toronto was playing for the draw and they were going to wait for their opportunity to maybe score a goal. Everyone's saying, oh no, it was a more open attacking game. I don't see it that way. What do you think?
I didn't see much in the way of chances. This might be always the case in terms of a match that always appears as though it's going to a draw. But I did think that the first half had more in it.
Yeah.
Which sort of, or at the very least, I certainly felt more engaged. I don't think that it, I think that the closer it got to 90 minutes, sort of the more the drama went out of it. And, or at least from the Toronto side, because Columbus definitely did press. I think if you were looking for attacking play out of Columbus, you got it.
Yeah, and I certainly don't think either team was not trying to score. Like, both teams had opportunities where they were pressing, but Toronto was very, very careful in the chances they took, and I don't believe really opened themselves up much at all when they were going forward. They sent players forward, but then when you also saw how deep Michael Bradley was sitting, essentially playing as a sweeper, yes, he got forward as well, but you know, the interceptions he was making were pretty deep into the Toronto zone a lot of the time.
Mm-hmm. What do you think? Do you think away goals will be a factor in the second leg?
Only if Columbus scores.
But one thing,
I was just going to say, and I don't want to, you know, call it too soon, but it, to me, watching that game, I went, even just fitness-wise, Columbus does not look up to the challenge. I find it very hard to believe they will go to Toronto, score a goal, and keep it at 1-0.
Yeah, it's not...
Because I guess 2-1 would send it to added time, but I just think it would be incredibly naive for anyone at this point to think that Toronto doesn't pretty handily beat Columbus. But, you know, Columbus, they're gonna work for it. It's not going to be just a capitulation or a rollover. However, the yellow card to Artur, knowing that that key player is going to be gone, I don't even see if you're Greg Berhalter, like, how you win this game in Toronto. I don't think they've got quite the personnel to do it or the fitness to do it.
I think you have to be really open to be able to like, I think that's the style that suits Columbus best in terms of scoring a lot of goals, which you need to do, because you're not gonna win 1-0. You're probably not gonna win 2-1. Mm-hmm. So you've got to be open and free flowing, and that's something that's better. That's a style of play better suited when you're at home. In credit, I think, despite the fact that I'm being a little hard on Toronto, credit to Drew Moore, who I thought had a great game, and sort of was the inspired player that got a result for Toronto, with a couple other people too. But I think that he was the standout player.
Yeah, I mean, I think we saw that Toronto has depth, right? Which is what people have talked about. I mean, was it a fantastic performance? No, but they had to play. Also say the thing about parking the bus a little bit, at least tactically, I think was the right decision. I think that missing your two top scorers going into hostile territory where very few people have won this season, you go and you get a 0-0 draw in Columbus and you take it back to your home stadium knowing you're going to have your full squad and you just go for it. Tactically, I think that's the right decision. But I also give credit to the players on the field for Toronto, as I thought they all had a pretty decent game and showed that Toronto still looks, if not the most threatening side without Altidore and Giovinco, certainly equal to the task. Very few points did they look worse than Columbus. Mm-hmm. We know Columbus is a very good side. If you're missing your two key players and you're still as good as one of the best teams in the league, that says a lot. And you can read it a lot of different ways, but and as you said, credit to those players. I think Betashore had a great game as well. Not that he doesn't have many great games when he's fit, but I don't think they're going to be too worried. I think, Columbus's way into this is you go to Toronto, you take it into added time, and you lock the back door, try to give up as few free kicks as possible, and if you can, take it to penalties, because we know that that's where Toronto struggles. And now, it's in their heads multiple times. They've struggled to put away penalties, period, and certainly in playoff situations, they've struggled with that. It's a very dim glimmer of hope, but I think winning this through open play, I don't know what tricks Columbus has up with their sleeve, but it's going to be very, very difficult to get much.
I think you brought up the Whitecaps thing when we first started talking about this. In the tactical decision Toronto made, I think when you're in the first half, whether you're the away or the home team, the decision to be risk-averse tactically is really most defensible when you actually have a reason why you're going to do better in the second leg. Like, this is the thing. It's okay. It's to a certain extent, it's not pretty, but it's okay. It's like I brought up at the time when we were talking about the Vancouver thing, it matters if it works. It's a good strategy if it works. It's a bad strategy if it doesn't work. And to say, well, our strategy is going to work because we have Sebastian Giovinco and Josie Altidore coming back next week is a great argument. And at the end of the Whitecaps, there was really no way to explain how that was going to happen at the time for the Whitecaps. And when they did lose in the second leg, they said, oh, they had better players than us, which to me negates the idea of doing that of the first leg strategy.
Yeah, there was no way that they knew or could anticipate that they would. It was not realistic to think that they could go to Seattle and score a goal.
All of this,
let alone many. So it was kind of like you didn't concede at home. However, I don't think Columbus's strategy was don't concede at home. Mm-hmm. It was don't lose the game, but try to win the game.
Yeah.
Certainly they are aware we don't want to give Toronto even a sniff, mm-hmm. and they were able to close them down. But Columbus was playing to win that game. It may have not always looked like it, but I'm sure they knew that that was their opening. If they could get a goal or two in that game and go to Toronto and hold it to a 0-0 draw, mm-hmm. or get a goal, there's many different combinations that could have worked in their favor. Now they've got a mountain to climb, and I also think they'll be equal to the task. They're going to go in with the idea to win the game in Toronto and get those precious away goals. I don't think it's going to work, but I think that's going to be their game plan.
Now, because something happening three times makes it a trend, We are now all talking about the fact that American fans are booing Michael Bradley. It happened in Atlanta. It happened in New York in the Red Bull series. And in Columbus, where the fans, the only thing they love doing more than chanting "Save the Crew," was booing Bradley every time he took a touch, which is being associated to his leadership being
on Toronto.
No, his leadership or lack thereof in the U.S. national team.
I don't know. I mean, honestly, I think obviously that plays into it. I think that Michael Bradley is no stranger to booing, and this is not the first time in his career it's happened, going into hostile territory. I think the Columbus fans are just having a go at him, and they'll use whatever ammunition they need. To me, that's the crowd being the 12th man. You know, it's a little excessive, but it's the playoffs. The crowd's trying to get behind their team, and they'll use whatever ammunition they can.
Credit.
I don't know.
Credit to Bradley, though, for coming out of the game afterwards and thinking, why don't I give them something to really boo about? With the following quote to the answer of the question, your thoughts on the crew potentially not being here.
And what did he say? I missed that.
He said, you really feel for the small group of loyal supporters that they have who have been here since the beginning. On the other hand, you cannot deny the fact that things here have really fallen behind in terms of atmosphere in the stadium, the quality of the stadium. I don't know who's at fault for that. There's a lot going on. I get that. As an outsider, I don't know who that falls on. But again, the reality is the league has continued to grow and grow. This is not the only one, but this is one of a few markets that has not kept pace. So,
Does he work for MLS?
I mean, he might. Like he's a designated player, so kind of.
I mean, yeah. I mean, I know we all work for MLS, but yeah. I mean, I don't know what to read into it. In some ways, I think I just try not to engage too much with the off the field politics of things. But like, as I said, Michael Bradley's used to it. I don't think he's going to lose any sleep over it. He's not my favorite player, but mentally, he's very strong. This is not the first place he's been booed in. It won't be the last, regardless of his involvement in the U.S. men's national team. He's a player that people love to hate. And, you know, soccer needs villains as much as it needs heroes, and I don't think Michael Bradley has any care about being the villain.
It's hard to read out of that first leg whether or not how a Toronto team might fare in the final if it reaches it. But I could look at that first leg between Houston and Seattle, where Seattle won with 2-0 with Houston receiving a red card, and think this was a comprehensive performance, and they certainly look ready.
Oh yeah. I mean, and just before we get to that, and talking about markets that haven't kept up, how are we not talking about Houston? I mean, what is their attendance? Like, was anybody, sorry, Houston fans, but like, where were you? Like, it seemed like there was slightly more people than are usually at a Houston Dynamo match, but I was like, did they know that they're in the playoffs? I mean, and Houston were never the favorites to beat Seattle, but yeah.
They don't seem to have, you would think, as much as you would be overshadowed by a team in the World Series and winning the World Series, you would think sports teams are generally pretty good in the same market of being pals with each other, and and you'd think they would be able to ride that wave a little bit more than they had. You know what it is, before we move away, it is interesting. Who else do you think Michael Bradley is thinking of? Don't stress too hard about it. But if you had to name one or two teams, what was the other team that came to Michael Bradley's mind in that moment that caused him to hedge his answer?
You know what? I genuinely don't know.
DC's building their stadium, so they don't count.
Yeah.
Dallas, maybe.
Yeah, it's entirely possible. I mean, I hate the business side of soccer, and MLS in particular seems quite dirty, and a little mafioso about how clubs get in. But, you know, besides the idiocy behind Columbus's ownership and their decisions and their communication and all of that, there is a larger point to be made here about the team's expansion and also what the plans from the league are. But I also, you know, if you think ahead maybe 10 years and this just idea of constant expansion of the league, or if a team's not doing well in one market, then it moves to another. I mean, at what point is there some level of consistency, and that's what brings a market in, right? Like, there's going to be dips in every single market, if that's what their concern is.
Yeah.
So I have trouble knowing what MLS's end game is. If, you know, like, how do you decide when it's time to just move a team? What's the threshold that somebody needs to be at? And, you know, if we're going to talk about shitty stadiums, then how does New York City FC have a team? Like, you know, there's teams that are still playing on baseball diamonds and like parking lots, and, you know, okay, the facilities in Columbus aren't great. However, again, what's the threshold? What's the measurement that we're using here? How do you decide what's good enough and what's not? Yes, you want to grow the league, you want to have certain types of facilities, but like, how do you measure that, and whose decision is that to make?
Key business indicators.
But what are they?
I honestly think that it has a lot to do with ownership. Not just a team's individual owner, but the other teams in the league, what people can make off of its expansion fees. It's like every league has this. This was something that I once heard in a podcast as the difference between the NASL and the USL in terms of ambition. This is something that I've heard of in regards to the NWSL, in terms of you have sort of like a block of owners who are happy with the way things are and a block of owners who would like to expand it further. You know, like, you always see this. And
yeah,
ultimately it's like, if you look at the average attendance of a Montreal in 20,000, it's not huge. It's good. It's not like, you know, the super high reaching attendances that some of the other teams are getting that are pushing for that. But you could tell that they're trying as a club. You could tell that they're, you know, invested, that they are seeking expansion and seeking growth in their market. And I feel like that is maybe something that you look at. And Columbus has an owner that has seemed not to be as interested in that in Columbus itself.
Yeah, for sure. Well, I guess the thing I always look at is like, what are the big soccer franchises that are making money? Mm-hmm. Owning sports teams is a terrible business decision. They do not, as a rule, make much profit. They're always going to be a money pit. Mm-hmm. And especially in the soccer world, where you look at when you want to talk actual top players, you know, look at the European transfer fees. There's never going to be an MLS team that can afford players in their prime from Europe. So I guess I'd just really be curious to know, again, like, what is the end game here? And yes, you want to continue to grow teams and grow markets and things like that. But to me, it feels like there is a bit of a ceiling for it, which is also like, you know, can we focus on playing good soccer and, you know, better promotion of the league in general, as opposed to just looking at one team and saying, oh no, they're not doing good enough, so we're going to move them somewhere else. And then every 5 years, teams move cities because it's hot for a while, and then they lose their star player, and then attendance goes down by 10,000, and 2 years later they decide to move the team again. Like, it's just... It's a little perplexing to me. It's the side of soccer that I care for the least.
There, without dwelling on it too much longer, I would say that it seems like there's something to be said for having capped it at 20 teams, which they didn't do. That seemed like the goal for the longest time, and now that we've surpassed that mark, it's hard to know what the new goal is.
And I wouldn't be surprised if they don't really know. I think they're trying to ride a wave of momentum that suddenly more people care about MLS. Not a lot more, but more. And they're just trying to be like, let's just run with it.
Indeed. It's a moment, it's an interesting moment to think about systems like Pro Rel when you have a lot of expansion franchises that you could say deserve or, in one way or another. Houston,
the game
Seattle.
Itself.
Houston, Seattle.
Yeah.
I, in the same way that not winning, that not being able to score at home really was a problem for Columbus, the moment that Jahlil Anibaba received a red card made it really hard for me to think that Houston was going to be able to win either that game or the second leg in the series in general. Even though they were only down 1-0, what did you think of that?
I completely agree. I don't think anybody thought that Houston had much of a chance at the outset. Anyway, they can be a bit of an unpredictable team, and they've shown their strengths. But I think the red card really was sort of a turning point. You could argue, well, then the massive save comes, and, you know, although you're down a player, they don't actually concede on the penalty, but then they still give up a goal later on, and the script is pretty much written. Especially now, I actually think the biggest decision, the biggest result out of that game is the fact that Albert Elise is missing the second leg from accumulation of yellows. I'm just going to say it, there's no way Houston wins this. They really, without Elise, a 2-0 loss at home. Like, come on. Like, there's just, I mean, I will go out and buy every last Houston Dynamo jersey, which I think is 6. well, no, there's probably got to be a lot left over because clearly no one went to the game. They're not going to go to Seattle and win 3-0.
No.
It's just not going to happen.
Big ups to Joe Willis, who came into the playoffs as the backup goalkeeper and sits at this moment as the only goalkeeper to have saved 2 penalties in the same playoff campaign.
Mm-hmm.
Which is
massive, massive save. Mm-hmm. In fairness, the penalty did not look to be particularly well taken. But, you know, doesn't matter. He's not going to lose any sleep over whether it was a good penalty or a bad penalty. He's just relieved to feel it hit his gloves and go out.
I think that it's unfortunate, and it is always going to be the case. You know what? I say it's always going to be the case when you go down to 10 men that you're going to have trouble with pressure. But, you know, I don't think there was nothing in the game in that second half. And maybe it was having the second yellow. Maybe it was just being deflated. But Seattle clearly took their foot off the gas pedal. And I don't know if you could be a little critical of Houston for not trying to stun them a little. But I guess it's just when you have a first half like that, it's not simple.
Well, and I guess the one win... No, it really isn't. And I think it's always going to be easier for the people sitting at home to say, why didn't you just do this and why didn't you just do that? And you don't... The tension's on the pitch. You know, there's a little bit of a dust-up at the half. mentally what a player and what a team needs to do to keep themselves moving ahead is it's not always just about who passes to who or seeing the opening. When you've got tensions flaring and there's so much on the line, it's easier to kind of see things after the fact. The one sort of interesting note here is that Seattle will be missing Roman Torres in the second leg, also for accumulation of yellows. So somebody that's just been an absolute rock for them is going to be missing. I don't think that's enough to mean that Houston's going to be able to come in and storm the breaches and really have that much effect. And Seattle has shown that, again, they're a team with depth as well. Mm-hmm. They'll definitely miss Torres, but I mean, 2-0 on away goals. They can go to Seattle and park the bus. I don't think they're going to, but I don't think it's going to be a particularly difficult game for them. Mm-hmm. It is going to be an extremely difficult game for Houston. Mm-hmm. They have to play open and they have to attack, which is going to leave them open. Will Bruin is in form. You know, Dempsey's Dempsey. He's always up for scoring a goal. There's no way that this does not end with Seattle winning. And of course, many, many predicted it. Mm-hmm. The interesting thing is, of course, I think we can safely say, we know it's going to be a Toronto-Seattle final. But who is going to win?
Let's close with that, because I wanted to maybe, since we were away for a bit, I also want to step up for just a second, at least in the reported attendance, to defend Houston a little bit. The reported attendance was 22,661,
okay,
with a stated capacity of 2,230, so 2,231.
Okay. I might have just seen the bits where a lot of people were in the washroom or getting beer after their team went down to 10 men, so, you know, sorry, Houston fans, I'm just saying, there's often a lot of empty seats in that stadium, so.
in a BBVA compass.
Yeah.
You've got to think that knowing that they would not, that the Western team is not going to host the MLS Cup final, that, like, the second leg is going to feel a little bit like one of those send off at the airports, except there's going to be a soccer game going on in the middle of it.
Yeah, it's very true. As we kind of wrap up here, there's a bit of other MLS news, and we might be a little bit selective with what we talk about. One was a bombshell you dropped on me that I somehow missed, and I can imagine other people missed it as well. And that has to do with our good friends in Portland.
Following their defeat to Seattle in the Eastern Conference semifinal, Caleb Porter has left the team. I'm double checking right now whether or not it was mutual or not. Caleb Porter is, quote, moving on.
Okay, so
apparently. So he wasn't, he was not fired but chose to depart. This is ESPN FC, according to both the club statement and multiple reports.
Yeah. This is one of the fascinating things about this league and the fact that MLS controls so much is that nobody ever seems to get fired. They just sort of move on. It's all very institutional and nice sounding. But it does sound like it, from what I've read it from multiple different sources, just while we've been setting up, is it seems like he decided to leave. Mm-hmm. And sort of he had this 5-year window, did things, but then again, that could be MLS spin as well. And they say, Caleb, you're going to be moving on. What would you like to say in your departing speech? But it also feels like I don't think there'd be anything in his performance this year that the ownership could be too upset about that would really warrant a firing, per se.
I love this idea of moving on into the sunset. Maybe tomorrow.
Yeah. Caleb Porter slings his bag over a pony and just rides off.
it's there is so much that we don't know, and I think that It makes almost more sense the other way of it being a firing. Or like it would have made more sense if it was a firing, because you could build a narrative around that, but the narrative around this is so strange unless he is on his way to coach the U.S. men's national team, which is, it's hard to know whether or not that's the case with an election of the USSF president still to happen. I feel like that decision hasn't been made yet. Pardon?
Yeah. One of the early rumors is that he could. One of the early rumors is that he could be headed to Seattle.
Wow! Could you imagine? Like, could you after? That would be one of the shortest, strangest tenures of Brian Schmetzer of a career for Brian Schmetzer, getting hired mid-season, going to the MLS Cup twice, and then leaving.
Yeah, I don't think it's likely, but I just saw the rumor and I thought it's fun to stoke the flames.
But even for Porter, he was quite successful. It's worth noting.
Yeah, and that's kind of where I feel like it is more of his decision is that I think his track record speaks for itself. That it wouldn't make a lot of sense from Portland's ownership side to have a proven coach who's built something, who did well again this year, to say, no, let's get him out. Because in MLS, it's always like, yeah, and then who takes over? And it's not like there's just a ton of great coaches sitting around ready to take the job. So that makes me believe that Caleb Porter is just looking for new scenery.
Also happening is that Real Salt Lake have announced they're going to have an expansion team in the NWSL. With the owner saying it was a commitment to equality, which I enjoy. From the NWSL perspective, it's worth, and this is something that the Canadian Soccer League people are thinking of, you know, it's worth thinking about whether or not you really want all your teams to be affiliated with the MLS. But from a more global perspective, I think that it's really good for a team to look at their pyramid structure and say, women belong in it.
Yeah, I agree. And I think that ultimately there's cases where separate markets have, I think, proven to be helpful. But we've also seen where the same market can also be helpful. And when you look at Orlando Pride and the fact that that team has kind of been able to come up with Orlando City, that seems to make sense as well. So, you know, whatever can be done to grow that league and interest in it, I think it's good. It's going to depend on the team and the market, but I think that's great news.
Former Montreal manager Mark DeSantos. Pardon?
Go ahead.
I was going to say former Montreal manager Mark DeSantos.
You go first.
has won the ASL Soccer Bowl with the San Francisco Deltas, 2-0 of the Cosmos. Had Canadians Nana Atakora, Carl Wimet, Maxime Tissot, and Kyle Becker on hand for the victory. The team is going to almost immediately fold, both on their own merits and because the NASL did not get their preliminary injunction against Division III sanctioning, which is kind of like the NASL story then and now is to win and fold in the same year. Just burn hard.
Yeah.
Dos Santos.
Yeah, just burn hot in Brighton.
And then go away. Dos Santos might be headed for the MLS was a story on MLSsoccer.com. Was the speculation with that open spot. And who knows if there are other open spots coming. I think it's weird announcing half of your awards when you've decided to step away for 2 weeks in the middle of the playoffs, but MLS have done that.
Yeah.
They're announcing them on a staggered schedule.
If we're going to talk key business indicators, maybe we could talk about marketing and when to announce things. And if you'd like people to be interested in your league, maybe have some sort of cohesive structure and schedule and messaging so that people can know to follow something, mm-hmm. rather than be like, oh, we'll do half of it this week. Best wearer of shorts, save of the first part of the year, or however they divide. Like, it's just do it one night. Americans love award shows. Why do they not have like a VMA style, just grotesquely over the top, grandiose award show? Nobody, you don't even need to know who the players are. People just watch for the like the halftime performance or something.
get some
you could have Clint,
get some celebrity or Taylor Twellman, whoever you can, to do it.
Who won best shorts?
Best shorts was won by, just off the top of my head, nobody did the thing. Nobody did the Joe Cannon thing and tucked the Joe Cannon a couple seasons ago when he tucked the inside of his shorts into his shorts while waiting for a penalty save. Your newcomer of the year award winner is Miguel Almirón of Atlanta over Nemanja Nikolic in Josef Martinez. With 37% of the vote. Two Atlanta players in the top three show how successful their acquisition strategies and expansion team were. There was some grumblings that Victor Vázquez, who only merited 9% of the overall vote, didn't do a little better. But I think that you look at a player like Almirón, and he's clearly not just being a key cog in the team, but being quite successful, scoring 9 goals.
Yeah, I think the newcomer thing too makes people feel like it meant to be a younger player. Mm-hmm. And I think that helps. But yeah, I mean, the fact that Vázquez landed so low, I get it. If you're a fan, it's not fair. But, you know, it's fan voted, and it's pretty hard to argue Almirón not winning. I mean, he really did have... He had a fantastic season... period, let alone it being his first season in MLS. Mm-hmm. The interesting thing now, of course, is that there's all this talk that he's not going to be staying.
Newcomer because... and outgoer of the year?
Yeah. Highest transfer fee awarded to an MLS player to go to Europe could also be won by Almirón. Mm-hmm.
Sporting Kansas City got the league lowest 29 goals allowed. And it's not a surprise that Tim Melia won Goalkeeper of the Year with 50% of the vote over Andre Blake and Stefan Fry. And Ike Opara won Defender of the Year over Justin Morrow and Kendall Waston.
Pretty fair, I think. Hard to argue. All good defenders, all good goalkeepers. But Casey's record, I think, spoke for itself this year. They did an exceptional job. It's too bad they didn't have more going forwards. The team couldn't have lasted a little bit longer and done more. But yeah, defensively, they were pretty spectacular.
Clint Dempsey, who missed much of last season with heart problems, won the Comeback of the Year award. Houston's DeMarcus Beasley won the Fair Play Award. Seattle won the Team Fair Play Award. And Alan Chapman won Ref of the Year. Are your award winners. So that's who we've named so far.
I don't want to be retroactively fined by Disco for saying anything about that last award, so... in fairness, I think Mark Chapman had a much better season than he's perhaps had. And, you know, a referee is always going to be the villain. You could say any referee's name. You could make up a referee name, and a bunch of fans would be like, that's an outrage, he's the worst, so...
Coach of the Year is coming on the 27th with Tata Martino, Veljko Paunović, and Greg Vanney in the running on the 27th. And the MVP award will be on the 4th with Almirón, Jovinko, Nikolic, Valeri, and Villa being on the ballot.
Hmm. All right. The last piece I just wanted to add, and we don't need to go into all the things that Whitecaps fans have gone into, but... the news that David Oestead, the goalkeeper of the Vancouver Whitecaps for the last 2-3 years, has made the decision to leave. Contentious because apparently he was offered an extension if he was ready to take a hefty pay cut. And this was actually, I think, back in June. So he's kept it quiet until the end of the season when he let the press know that he won't be back. The Whitecaps still, as of yet, have not released any official statement.
Really?
Nothing that I've seen, nothing on whitecapsfc.com, which is their style. The thing I will say to end on a positive note, especially for Oestead, is that the Vancouver Southsiders, which is the main supporters group for them, threw a going-away party for him at a local Irish pub. The day that Denmark beat Ireland was the day that they held this, and David Oestead came, spent a long time with supporters, and so it was nice that supporters recognized his contributions to the club, but also that he recognized the support, a well-loved figure in Vancouver, and we wish him well in whatever's next for him. Maybe he forms an offshoot with Caleb Porter or something, and Cascadia FC.
It is incredibly sad to see him go. It is very special that he chose to go to that party and that the supporters threw it for him. I feel like it's the bad PR juju around such a thing is such that you rarely see that kind of thing. So it's special that it happened. And you know, he will, I don't think it's possible to doubt that he really brought his all to the team and did his best to try and promote the team on the pitch and in the community.
Absolutely.
Pardon. Yes.
That's all. I just said absolutely.
Do we want to really quickly run off predictions?
do we need to?
Do we want to?
I can do mine.
Do we want to put a number to it?
Wait, are we predicting the final, or we predict? I think we've predicted the next game.
Do we want to put numbers on our predictions of the second leg?
Sure. You go first this time.
Seattle 3, Houston 1, Toronto 2, Columbus 1. No, Toronto 2, Columbus 1.
I should have talked about it. I think I was thinking of the final match. This is a little bit harder. I'm going to say Toronto 3, Columbus 0. Mm-hmm. And I am going to say Seattle 2, Houston 0. I think it'll be another 2-0.
I'm just looking at this and thinking, well, I happen to be in Toronto on December 9th at 4 o'clock Eastern Time. I wonder if there's going to be a game going on at BMO Field at that time.
I think it's a safe bet.
Well, where can we find you online?
You can find me online at Twitter at ThatSoMLS. I've been a little quiet on there, but I'll get back in there soon and chat with you. Where can we find you?
You can find me at Team Bates, www.team-bates.com. You can also go to whatahowler.com to check out the wonderful things they do there. Until next time, where we learn whether or not our wonderful predictions took place, don't get sent off.
You too, buddy.